Tuesday, August 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Turkey's battle against Kurdish forces could tip the balance in Syria. Terrorism is top on John Kerry's visit agenda to Bangladesh.
With the suppression of viral replication, you reduce the amount of the virus that's in an infected person.
A possible breakthrough in Zika treatment. Also ahead, predicting the future in the Old Farmer's Almanac. It's all on today's International Edition. In northern Syria, Kurdish YPG fighters are reportedly reinforcing the recently captured town of Manbij in the face of advancing Turkish and allied rebel forces. Reuters cited security sources as saying vehicles loaded with fighters, weapons, and equipment were seen moving east to west. Manbij, located west of the Euphrates River, was a stronghold of the Islamic State until taken by a U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces earlier this month. The SDF withdrew earlier this month after handing control over to local officials. Turkish officials said their offensive is aimed at preventing the Kurds from expanding their territory as well as driving Islamic State fighters from their strongholds. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales tells VOA's Victor Beattie that the Turkish incursion could weaken if the Kurds as one of the most effective fighting forces confronting the Syrian government and Islamic State.
The people that the Turks are most concerned about are members of the Syrian Democratic Force and their militia, the People's Protection Units, known as the YPG. They're reasonably closely connected to the PKK, which is a fairly radical Turkish nationalist group based essentially in Turkey. So what's happening is that the Turks have gone after this group, which has been the most effective force fighting Islamic State on the ground. The danger is it's going to detract attention from Islamic State, weakening the Kurds and their capacity to take on Islamic State, and probably not really achieving a hell of a lot from the point of view of the Turks.
The Syrian Democratic Forces, as you know, is backed by the U.S., recently captured a key IS stronghold called Manbij, and apparently the Turks are aimed at taking Manbij.
Well, this is somewhere where, and I'm not sure the extent to which the U.S. and the Turks are agreed on this, but Mr. Biden came out the other day and essentially saying that the Kurds had to back away from Manbij because it's on the wrong side of the Euphrates River.
Turkey's thrust is the result of what, all these suicide bombings in Turkey?
Erdogan decided about a year and a half ago, when he had a very bad electoral result, to create essentially a domestic security issue with the Kurds and started picking on the Kurds. And it's sort of snowballed from there. And so you've had problems with the PKK coming in from Iraq into Turkey. You've had Islamic State coming into Turkey and making attacks. And so, yes, it is to an extent a response to that, but it's perhaps more important an attempt to prevent the Kurds in Syria from forming a solid geographic bloc. Because up until now, they've been scattered all over the northern part of Syria without any real geographic contiguity.
Mr. Erdogan Sunday vowed to devote equal energy in combating both Islamic State jihadists and the Syrian Kurdish fighters. Will that be possible?
Probably not. I think he's starting to respond to pressure from the U.S. and others to reduce his tolerance, if not support, for Islamic State and other extremist groups. He may be forced to take action given the bombings that you've mentioned, but I think really his main focus is to stop the Kurds, because he's concerned about the contagion effect that the Kurds in Turkey will see the Kurds in Syria, with whom they have close ties, doing well, forming a sort of a government. They've got an area called Rojava, which is being run almost on socialist or communist lines, and seems to be doing reasonably well in the context.
Anthony Billingsley warned the Turkish incursion could prolong the Syrian conflict, which erupted in March 2011 and has cost nearly 300,000 lives, as well as displacing millions of Syrians. It's time for us now to look at social media. Michael Lippin is here to tell us about reaction to the passing of a Hollywood great. Michael?
Hi, Jim. Well, we are talking about the great comedic actor Gene Wilder, who passed away on Monday at the age of 83. Wilder was best known for some hit movies in the 60s and 70s, including The Producers, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, and one of my childhood favorites, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which is based on that book by Roald Dahl. Now, the cause of Wilder's death was revealed in a public letter released by his nephew, and U.S. TV network NBC Nightly News tweeted an image of that letter. In it, the nephew says that Wilder died of complications from Alzheimer's disease, a condition that hadn't previously been disclosed, and the nephew explains why the family chose to keep that condition private, namely so that more children would enjoy his classic role as Willy Wonka without having their enjoyment spoiled by adults telling them that Wilder was dying.
Well, what have Wilder's peers in the comedy industry been saying about his passing?
Well, I've got a couple of tweets to share with you. Here's one from his longtime collaborator, Mel Brooks, who is 90 years old and still going, if you can believe that. Brooks said, "Gene Wilder, one of the truly great talents of our time. He blessed every film that we did with his magic, and he blessed me with his friendship." And we also have two stars of the 1990s hit comedy series Seinfeld sharing their thoughts. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is at Official JLD, said, "Rest in peace, dear, wonderful Gene Wilder. What an influence you were in my life. Thank you for all that joy." We also have Jason Alexander, her co-star. He is at iJasonAlexander, and he said, "Gene Wilder touched my life, my heart, and my funny bone with his unique and genius work. May he rest with peace and joy." And here's what American TV host, producer, writer, and comedian Jimmy Kimmel had to say, simply that Gene Wilder was the best. If you'd like to weigh in with your favorite Wilder movie, the Hollywood Reporter news site has a Twitter poll going. It's on Twitter at THR, and the choices are The Producers, Blazing Saddles, Willy Wonka, and Young Frankenstein. And you can probably guess what I'm going to ask you now, Jim. What would you choose?
I'm voting for all of them. There's the politically correct answer.
Okay.
They're great. All of them are fantastic movies. Check them all out. You've got time.
Yes, I think I will.
Thank you so much, Michael. Michael Lippin with social media analysis, and you can follow him on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson, and we also invite you to follow our international edition stream. That's at VOA_IE. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, Indian Defense Minister signs major logistics agreement with the Pentagon. Philippines President to raise sea feud ruling against China's wishes. Excluded Myanmar rebel groups highlight challenges for NLD. Committee to Protect Journalists says journalists in India covering corruption may pay with their lives. A rights group builds a legal case against Pyongyang abusers. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website. And if you have a smartphone, on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Bangladesh Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina expressed a very clear desire to cooperate with the United States very, very closely on fighting terrorism. That, according to Secretary of State John Kerry, who announced the two countries had agreed to additional steps by which our intelligence and law enforcement will work together to try to get ahead of this. And by that, he means terrorism. VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman is traveling with Secretary Kerry and has more in a conversation with International Edition host Sarah Williams.
According to Secretary Kerry, Sheikh Hasina, the prime minister, was very keen for closer cooperation with the United States, and they have taken several unspecified measures to have closer cooperation among intelligence and law enforcement authorities in Washington and Dhaka to combat violent extremism.
Did Secretary Kerry talk with reporters afterwards, about efforts to crack down on terrorism in Bangladesh?
Well, he did take a couple of questions from the media after he delivered remarks at the Edward Kennedy Center in Dhaka. Those remarks were, as they say, wide-ranging, but he did touch on this issue, and we put a question to him about whether there would be specific measures, and he answered in the affirmative. He also denied what analysts have been saying, which is that the Bangladeshi government has its head in the sand when it comes to acknowledging that there are outside influences and contacts from groups such as Al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State with militants inside Bangladesh. And he said Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina and other ministers did not protest that assertion when he put it forward, that there is at least one group in South Asia which has contacts with Islamic State. However, the Reuters news agency contacted Bangladesh's home minister, who said he, in the meeting, did bluntly say that there was no linkage between the homegrown militants and groups such as Islamic State. So a bit of a contradiction there from the U.S. and Bangladeshi side about the characterization of those meetings today.
And what about the issue of human rights? Bangladesh is a country where, in recent months, bloggers and other activists have been killed by extremists.
Yes, the secretary, in his remarks, did make reference to that, saying that in the fight against terrorism, we need to uphold the values of democracy. But he did not specifically criticize, at least in public, the Bangladeshi government on those issues, although a group of UN experts last week came out with a statement where they called for lifting the death penalty in a retrial of a Jamaat-e-Islami leader. There is a widespread perception among human rights activists that these rights are being violated in Bangladesh, and that the Sheikh Hasina government is using the fight against terrorism to go after political enemies to some degree.
Well, now, Secretary Kerry also met with opposition leader Khalida Zia. How did those talks go?
Former Prime Minister Khalida Zia leads the largest opposition party in Bangladesh. However, it boycotted the most recent national election and has no members in parliament at present, but it is a potent force in Bangladeshi politics. Khalida Zia and Sheikh Hasina are known as the battling Begums. This is a fierce political rivalry between these two women, which has gone back for decades. And it has just polarized Bangladeshi politics for many, many years. So in the eyes of most observers, it was prudent for Secretary Kerry to hold this meeting with Khalida Zia, which did occur at the U.S. Embassy in the afternoon.
VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman. Researchers here in the United States have identified a number of drug compounds that stop the spread of the Zika virus, as we hear more from VOA's Jessica Berman.
The search for a drug to treat or at least prevent transmission of the Zika virus is urgent. The illness, spread by the bite of a mosquito and sexually by infected men, can cause microcephaly in developing fetuses. Babies with the condition are born with abnormally small heads and brains, causing a host of devastating disabilities. The disease already has infected thousands of women from Brazil through North America. In those who are not pregnant, the virus causes relatively minor flu-like symptoms, although it can also cause a rare neurological disease in adults called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Researchers at the U.S. National Institutes of Health screened a library of 6,000 existing drugs and experimental compounds, and they identified two promising groups. Investigators at Florida State University in Tallahassee and Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore then tested the drugs in the laboratory. The compounds were shown to block the ability of Zika virus to kill cells and to keep the microbe from reproducing within infected cells. However, says Florida State University Biological Sciences professor and researcher Hong Li Tang, if and when the drugs become available, they would not be used in pregnant women. Safety trials in pregnant women would need to be conducted first.
Even if you can treat Zika-infected men, or non-pregnant woman, you can still has a potential to cut down transmission, because with the suppression of viral replication, you reduce the amount of the virus that's in an infected person, and that can reduce the chance of transmission by mosquito bites or sexually.
News of the compound's discovery was published in the journal Nature Medicine. Tang says it's possible researchers could eventually formulate the drugs to give to pregnant women.
If a compound is modified, antiviral is modified enough that's safe to use during pregnancy, and then the mechanism of the antiviral would be reduce the virus to a low enough level, you will have a much lower or zero chance of getting to the fetus to begin with.
The compounds have been what scientists called repurposed, meaning they already have received regulatory approval for use or testing in humans for other disorders. That could speed the time it takes to get Zika drugs to the public. Even so, Tang predicts it might be 2 more years before that happens. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. The 2017 Old Farmer's Almanac is predicting a very cold and snowy winter here in the United States. The editor of the oldest continuously published periodical in North America, Janice Stillman, talks about the publication's 225th edition with International Edition's Lori London.
By and large, across the country, it's going to be colder this winter than it was last winter, which was pretty mild to just about everybody, but it will still be above normal temps this coming winter. Colder than last year, but certainly some cold spells, but overall, when all is said and done, it will be above normal temperatures. As for snow, really, the heaviest amounts of snow are going to fall along the Canadian border and maybe within 200 to 500 miles south of the Canadian border. Certainly down through the Appalachians as well. That's probably the lowest southern dip of snowfall that we'll see this winter coming up. And the mitten of Michigan, that area around and north of Detroit, is not going to need mittens this winter. We're looking at mild and relatively wet versus white weather there. Florida will be mild and wet, and unfortunately in Southern California we're calling for cooler temperatures but also continuing dry conditions, so no relief from the drought.
Where do you come up with the predictions for the upcoming seasons?
Our weather forecasts are based on three scientific disciplines: solar science, which is the study of the activity on the sun, in particular the sunspots; climatology, which is the study of prevailing conditions over time; climatology, which is the study of prevailing conditions over time, looking back over decades and even centuries; and meteorology, which is the study of the atmosphere, but also the ocean temperatures, the land temperatures, the jet streams, and things of that sort. The distinction with the Old Farmer's Almanac weather forecast from just about everybody else is the solar science. We study the sunspots that occur in cycles of 11 years on average. And here's the thing. The cycles have been getting smaller and smaller. That is to say, there's been less and less activity on the sun over the past several years and looks to be even less activity in the years coming up. And that historically, looking at climatology now, historically has indicated cooler than normal temperatures, not just indicated, but produced cooler than normal temperatures here on Earth. However, we've also recognized for several years now that the greenhouse gases are influencing the atmosphere and weather conditions here on Earth. And so right now we're thinking that the greenhouse gases are mitigating any cooling effects of the low sunspot count. So it will be very interesting to see how climatology and other patterns play out over the next couple of years and decades.
How accurate have your predictions been?
Well, traditionally, the accuracy rate of the weather forecast at the Old Farmer's Almanac is 80%. We simply don't believe that anybody can be 100% accurate all the time. And, you know, that's okay. We'll take 80. But unfortunately, we have to settle for about 55 for this past winter, 55% accuracy rate, that is, because we simply didn't anticipate that the El Nino of this past winter and parts of the spring would blow out, would become the large-scale El Nino that it did.
What else can people find in the Old Farmer's Almanac?
Well, the Old Farmer's Almanac is a calendar of the heavens, so you've got all of the astronomical events for the coming year, from the sunrise and sunset, and moonrise and moonset, full moons, length of day, oh so important as we go through the year, the various other conjunctions and other visions to see in the sky. And, you know, it's useful with a pleasant degree of humor. So it's a reference book that also has lots of tips and advice and recipes. But sometimes on the silly side, I have to admit, for example, we've got dog training for busy people, teacher train how to change a light bulb and do your child's math homework. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. But we've also got some advice for the lovelorn and other folks seeking companionship, how to woo on the web with great advice like men, choose a username that suggests you're smart or clever, and ladies, pick one that hints at your appearance. Or consider this when you take your photo for Facebook or a selfie for LinkedIn or any of those other websites. Center yourself in the photo frame, tilt your head, and smile enough to cause eye creases. There's also a fun story on beer in the White House. Froth of our fathers. From the earliest days, Americans and their presidents have been brewing beer and drinking beer, and we've got the story behind that for 225 years. That's in celebration of the 225th edition of the Old Farmer's Almanac, which indeed is marked by the 2017 edition.
Janice Stillman of the Old Farmer's Almanac on International Edition. For director Tracy Carter and engineer Jim Harmon, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After recent meetings in Nairobi with foreign ministers of a number of regional partners, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said that a regional protection force authorized by the United Nations Security Council is necessary to protect civilians in South Sudan's capital of Juba and to help facilitate the implementation of a peace accord reached by South Sudan's warring factions last year. The Security Council approved the Regional Protection Force within the United Nations mission in South Sudan on August 12th, after violence broke out in and around the capital between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and former First Vice President Riek Machar. During the height of the July 7th to 11th violence, soldiers from both sides committed heinous crimes, including rape, murder, and wanton destruction of property. Government forces also attacked UN protection of civilian sites and a UN compound. Since 2013, when the conflict first started in South Sudan, the country has been ravaged, with thousands of people killed and over 2 million driven from their homes. Secretary Kerry noted that all the ministers who met in Nairobi agreed on the need for the deployment of the up to 4,000-member protection force authorized by the UN Security Council. Secretary Kerry emphasized that the force does not challenge the sovereignty of the country. It has, he said, a very clear mandate to protect people for their access, their freedom of movement, and their ability to remain free from attack or ambush from any source whatsoever. The hope is, he said, that the protection force will restore stability, will help the country to move faster to reconcile, will help by its presence alone provide assurance and confidence to people about the future. Mr. Kerry announced that the United States, which is the largest donor of humanitarian relief to the people of South Sudan, will give an additional $138 million toward that effort, bringing its total contribution to more than $1.7 billion. But the overwhelming need in the country, Mr. Kerry said, is to reinvigorate an inclusive political process and to implement the reforms that are set out in the peace agreement. Secretary of State Kerry urged the people of South Sudan to respect their countrymen as equal under the law and to demand that their leadership stop this fighting on an ethnic basis and get to the business of running the country in a responsible and inclusive way.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.